From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The claim that Donald Trump has been restrained from improving relations with Russia by his own staff has garnered a lot of attention in the U.S. over the past year and a half, and it got additional air over the past weeks in the wake of the release of the Mueller report. But is it true? For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero from Philadelphia via Skype on Thursday. Professor Montero, thank you for joining us. A pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don.
So, we're looking at this situation now, particularly again at the release of the Mueller report. Media reports that picture Trump, portray Trump as being captive to his aides who were stopping him from doing bad stuff. And given in particular that the central narrative in opposition to Trump from mainstream power sources is that he wants detente with Russia, and that's obviously bad because Russia's bad, and so the only reason that we aren't buddy-buddy with Russia is because the angels around Trump are keeping him from doing it, his policies being frustrated. Gareth Porter wrote about this phenomenon a year ago, and that article was making its way around social media again the last couple of days. But this is something that's been in the forefront of the conversation again, this allegation that Trump has no control over his foreign policy. He's been boxed into a corner. His better instincts towards Russia, China, or whatever are being blocked. And instead, what we see with the toughness against Iran, Venezuela, et cetera, is all that's going to be coming out of this White House.
Yeah. Well, what Gareth Porter is saying, I mean, we've been saying, as you know, for now, over 3 years,
right.
3.5 years, maybe
yep.
4 years.
Yeah, close.
Yeah, close to that. And it was, it was very apparent if you went back to the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton was the candidate of ratcheting up tensions and creating circumstances for actual war with Russia. And Trump had said time and again that he was not in favor of that, including Hillary Clinton's proposal for a no-fly zone over Syria, which would have put the United States and Russia in a direct confrontation. And that when Trump won, which was a shock to the nervous system and brain of the political class and most of the ruling elite, they then went in to a delegitimizing of his presidency and creating circumstances that have now crystallized where there is talk of impeachment of Trump. But again, it all goes back to the overall foreign policy objectives of the U.S. Ruling elites, and that is to be the single superpower militarily to block Russia and its development of defensive weaponry and to block China's emergence as the major economic power in Asia and much of the world. So I think that is what it is all about. I don't think we need to play around the edges of this. It's not about Trump's position on the southern border and immigration. It's not about his statements after the Charlottesville demonstrations and the death of the one young woman. It's not about any of these issues. It is about the U.S. empire and how it moves forward in a moment when China is ascendant in Asia militarily and economically, when around China are several other nations, including Russia and the Koreas, maybe Japan, and where Russia is now asserting itself as a Asian nation and is not looking to being integrated into the West. I think this is what it's all about. As I said, his election, Trump's election, drove the ruling elites crazy, and they're still operating in this atmosphere that they've created of hysteria. And, you know, we just got to get this guy out of here at any cost.
It seems that it's like a singular obsession with the media.
Obsession. Yeah, I agree with the obsession. It is an obsession, and it's hysterical.
Yeah. It's the main subject matter of CNN and MSNBC almost every day. I mean, I don't sit with a stopwatch, but just, you know, random, you know, drop-ins, the majority of the time that they speak on air, they're criticizing Trump in one fashion or another. I've never seen anything like this, even when they go to war against somebody, like Iraq or Libya or whatever, and they have these media campaigns where it's, you know, sort of, you know, all Saddam Hussein all the time. It doesn't seem as... I don't know, just as wall-to-wall as it is now. Yeah. And this has been going on since 2015, really. Since whenever it was that Trump first mentioned the word obsolete in connection with NATO, they've started going crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's so interesting because they're tripping over themselves. And because they can't get a hold on events, including the fact that now you have 20 Democrats who've announced that they're running for president, but they can't get a hold of events, and they are increasingly incapable of directing and shaping events. They've become more hysterical, more crazy. And as such, you know, it's so interesting that unintendedly they are creating more positive conditions for Trump to be reelected. That's, you know, Trump's reelection is not, in my opinion, going to be a unvarnished positive thing for humanity and for the people of the United States. How, whatever way things go, it will require profound organization and pressure from the people. And the stuff that got him elected, there were two principal things: no war, no intervention, no regime change. That's one. That's the peace thing and détente with Russia. And the second thing is that he would overcome and change the policies of austerity. Now, you know, he's not been successful on either front, although people are giving him the benefit of the doubt, which they do not give to the Democrats, who people see operating in bad faith. Now, in spite of the what they call the blue wave of 2018, where they ran pretty much on health care and bringing the cost of prescription drugs down, and as soon as they got in, it became all about impeachment and this, you know, this utopian dream of the new new Green Deal. I think it's a party in disarray, and I think Trump, in spite of the failures of his administration, and I include among those failures this allowing Bolton and Pompeo to decide a part of foreign policy, or a good part of foreign policy, in particular Venezuela and Iran, and they're muffing up the negotiations with North Korea. So I think even if he's reelected, he has a lot of work to do to dig himself out of this foreign policy quagmire and crisis that he's allowed himself to be drug into.
You know, you could put an accent mark over all of that, just looking at events over the last few days, because, you know, you don't come to a crisis in a particular practice until the practice is no longer functioning properly and people start to take notice of it. And so, you know, the idea that, you know, Trump is creating some sort of a crisis in international relations by trying to reset U.S. foreign policy in a couple of key ways, like with the, you know, interventions, like with relations with Russia and others, that, you know, if he did just left that alone and let it follow the course that it was following, then things would be peachy. But, of course, they're not. It is because exactly the opposite, because the U.S. foreign policy hasn't reset, that we're seeing a further consolidation globally of an alternate power structure. We saw just the last few days, with Tuesday this week, you had 71 nations in the in an East China port city participating in joint naval maneuvers with China. And at the next day, in Moscow on Wednesday, you had people from all over the world that were meeting for the 8th Moscow International Security Forum, which, you know, again, with country after country after country acknowledging essentially the fact that the United States is the greatest threat to peace in the world at the moment.
Absolutely.
And so,
absolutely.
You know, as you bully this one, that one, and another, you know, we said a million times that if you throw everybody out of the room one at a time, at some point in time, you're standing by yourself.
Yeah, and you know, the way you put that together is very helpful, you know, because several of those events people are not aware of because they don't make the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is obsessed with impeachment, getting Trump out of there. The world moves forward. And you didn't mention Kim Jong-un and Vladivostok meeting
with correct.
Putin.
That's correct. Absolutely.
And that's huge. Because as you remember, you know, since the 1990s, mid-1990s, China and Russia in the Security Council had gone along with sanctions after sanctions upon North Korea. Now it seems that North Korea is not only broken out of those sanctions, but has really positive relations with both China and Russia and South Korea. Now, to a certain extent, we can give some of the credit to Trump and the fact that there are no military exercises around or on the Korean Peninsula. We definitely can give him that credit, or the fact of the withdrawal from Syria and from Afghanistan. These are all positive developments. He, as Gareth Porter points out, he's been blocked by the institutional power and bureaucratic power of the intelligence and security, national security services, and the foreign policy, military policy, bigwigs in the Pentagon and the State Department. So he's been blocked. He's made some gains. At the same time, he's, you know, allowed himself by Bolton and Pompeo to be pulled in, and maybe Marco Rubio, into a failing policy in Venezuela. It's it's failing and will fail, and it will be ignominious. And then this sanctions, not just on Iranian oil, but anybody that does business with Iran. And that means China, who the United States is currently involved in trade negotiations, and we were told by Trump that they're close to a major agreement. Now you're going to put sanctions on them because they're going to buy oil from Iran. It does not make sense. But it does indicate that that the Trump administration is shorthanded, was for the most part sanctioned and boycotted by most of the foreign policy establishment for the very reasons that Gareth Porter gives. They saw him as a disruptor and moving in an opposite way to where the establishment wanted to go. And by the way, it has been U.S. policy since the collapse of the Soviet Union to move NATO further and further east to surround Russia and, in fact, to pull off a color revolution if they could, and to oust Putin or anyone like Putin, and to make Russia a servile state of the West and of the United States in particular.
Right, particularly oil companies and such.
True.
And, you know, I want to float this past you. This, I've been rolling this around in my head for quite some time, I think. You look at what Trump's been doing with, say, Israel, for example, with moving the capital and the things that are more symbolic than anything
right.
else, but very, you know, have great emotional attachment for partisans yes. on either side of the issue. And also the things, likewise, with Cuba, Venezuela, and
Nicaragua.
Yeah, Nicaragua as well. Although there was some material, I would suggest that there was actually some material harm done by the United States in Nicaragua last year, you know, the what in terms of inciting, you know, riots and such, that that there was a more active U.S. role in that, I believe. But but I don't know that for a fact. But in any event, where if you take a look at the 2020 election scenario, the place where Trump was most vulnerable in losing what helped put him over in 2016 was Florida. And if you look at Israel and Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua against Florida politics, this is big stuff. So I'm assuming that what's driving this, because he hasn't, I'm suggesting, and you know, as an assumption, that what's driving this is that he's looking at electoral politics. He's looking at the relations between the United States, Russia, and China as being the primary thing that has to be set right.
Right.
And that this is obvious to me, and I'm sure to you and to people that are paying attention, this is the central point of contention with the elites here, because they see relations with Russia going exactly as you described, that, you know, Russia's a giant oil, gas, and gold mine or whatever, and everybody shut up and bring that stuff over here. And China is supposed to be a slave labor factory and, you know, an ultimate bailing out for every time we mess up our currency, just drop some of that money over here and fix it for us. That's supposed to be their role. And obviously, they're not playing that role. The Obama administration brought things to the point, but they've been going there for you know, Bush's administration and Clinton's as well, to the point where Russia and China declared strategic partnership, which is something that had, you know, a condition that hadn't existed since the 1960s or even 50s. Is it possible that what Trump is doing is subordinating these other issues? Again, like Iran is like that as well. He's talked a lot of stuff with Iran. The sanctions are, of course, very damaging economically. But it's not a war, and it's something that, as you saw with Trump in Korea, he was grinding Korea down when he started out. It opened a path for him to be able to do what's been done to this point and not lose anything from his base over it, but rather add to it. Do you think maybe that game might be in play, or in any event, since that is a dynamic that's out there, is it something we should be working to try to force on him?
Yeah, I think we have to consider that. And since Trump is so media savvy, one of the things we've never had a more media savvy person in the White House as Trump.
Right.
And he does understand the performative character of being president. And so it's always possible that he's playing two tracks at the same time.
Right.
A public media, and I won't call it diplomacy, although you might wish to, a public media strategy where he says things that I consider crazy and wild, such as the UN speech about Rocket Man. And then he backs off and says, I love this guy, and he's one of the nicest people I've ever met. The same with Russia. Obviously, after Helsinki, he had to back off. The Congress passed a lot of sanctions and even some resolutions that tied his hands in his dealings with Russia.
And they were talking treason in the press across the board.
Absolutely.
Treason.
Absolutely. And he, from the very beginning, if you read Bob Woodward's book, Fear, he, from the very beginning, that is, soon after being inaugurated, was taken to the Pentagon, and he said that he was not going to play along with the military strategy of the generals. Right. And they knew then that this was a dangerous figure. But again, I think, like you, I'm interested in the long game.
Right.
And that's probably what separates the both of us from what goes for the left in this country.
Yeah.
They react to everything, but are incapable of understanding very much of anything. So I agree, for example, with Stephen Cohen when he talks about Trump's policy of, and this is the, these are the words of Cohen, of détente with Russia. When have you heard that language used in the last 30 years?
That's his Gerald Ford.
Pardon me.
That's his Gerald Ford.
That's right, maybe. And I mean, it's just, and so even with China, and it was with Putin too, with Xi Jinping, the same thing, and with Kim Jong-un, Trump's public diplomacy is to show that he and these various leaders are friendly and can talk to each other, which is a huge gesture in public diplomacy.
Yeah.
Now, but Trump has crazy advisors around him like John Bolton and Elliot Abrams. These people are not in their right minds. And he cannot allow them, in spite of the difficulty that he's facing domestically, he cannot give them a free hand in foreign policy, especially in Venezuela. And again, I say, you know, yeah, Trump came out talking a lot of stuff, all options are on the table, impose sanctions, seize their assets in the United States. The British did the same thing, by the way. But Maduro and the Maduro government is in a better and stronger position politically now than before all this began.
Yep.
I would say similarly with Iran. The United States and the Trump administration, as in Venezuela, in spite of, you know, some 50 countries, they say, supporting this guy Guaido, the United States will be isolated.
Right.
It will be isolated because I think Putin and Xi Jinping are master strategists.
Right.
And they play the long game, and they're playing it, I mean, as well as it can be played.
Yep.
And again, I'll just say, you know, Trump is being tricked into traps that will not play to his benefit.
Well, this is the question here that I want to flesh out some, because
go ahead.
You rightly point out that, you know, Reagan was supposedly the media president, but in fact, Reagan made movies in the 30s and 40s,
right.
and he made TV commercials in the 50s, and that was his media stuff. Trump, you know, has been doing modern, you know, virtual reality stuff. The Apprentice is a whole other animal that,
yeah,
you know, that fits into today's media scape just fine. And so what you're talking about is with him presenting this, you know, media imagery or whatever, is the thing that we Marxists refer to as the difference between appearance and essence, even just materialist philosophy. So,
yeah.
And on that point, if you take a look at what's happened, well, the way it played out with North Korea, for example, against the measure of, you know, is this appearance or essence? You have to look at how things develop and the outcomes to understand the essence, because if you think the essence is this, if the outcome isn't predictable, then you didn't understand the essence. So given that, no one would have thought that we were headed to where we are with Korea. Right. A year and a half ago, whatever. Looking at Iran, at Venezuela, looking at all of these things, the same openings that he made for himself that by getting credentials, basically, I'm the hardest person in the world on Kim Jong-un. That enables him to turn around and say, my man, when he sees him the next time, and not lose a constituency over it, but rather lose the people who are still advocating that policy. By bringing, could you have a more apparent animosity to Latin America than hiring Bolton and Abrams?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a supermarket somewhere that's missing two baggers. And now they're front and center in policy. But as they do these ridiculous things and those policies fall, he has the room to turn around and dismiss them both with a pat on the back and an attaboy out of respect to the constituencies that they have, such as they are, and turn around on policy and say, I tried that, it don't work, okay? It's not because I don't want to try it, but it don't work. Let's try this. It worked with Korea.
Well, and we have a very recent example of that with, quote, Mad Dog, end quote, Mattis.
That's
who,
right.
You know, who was trumpeted, forgive whatever
pun,
you call
yeah,
that.
Right, the pun.
Yeah, the pun. Trumpeted by Trump at the 2016 Republican Party convention as Mad Dog. He was going to be hard, and it was going to be peace through strength. Right. Well, Mad Dog is gone over the issue of Syria withdrawal of troops. And you're right. I mean, he has that possibility. The other thing is that, and I think many of the books on his presidency that I've read recently says, and a lot of the news reported says the same thing, he does not govern through committee. He does have something of an autocratic style, if you will. In other words, he has this understanding that everybody in his White House or in his administration are there because of him and have those positions as long as they do what he wants done. Right. And I think that applies to foreign policy. I think that applies to Bolton and Abrams, as you have suggested, and Pompeo, by the way.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, you know, so given all of that, and we've only got about a minute and a half left, given all of that, taking a look at the situation right now that's been developing with Venezuela, we have, as of today, Thursday, activists that are in the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., to protect it from a rumored attempt to unseat Venezuela's delegation in favor of a Guaido-backed, ambassador to the United States. The reality is, in the background, however, this is the embassy to the U.S. The U.S. already has direct contact with Guaido. He's their puppet. They don't need an ambassador to communicate with him, too. And the only people that can communicate with the actual government, the one, you know, that runs the stoplights and the traffic cops and everything in Venezuela, is the one that's in there now. So if they send them home, they have nobody to talk to, basically, on a daily basis. So you have, like, this material sort of, conscribing of what these people can do, no matter what the rhetoric is. And I guess I kind of used up the last minute and a half, and we're out of time. Tony, I'd like to pick this up with you next week in about the same spot, and I appreciate your time and your work, as always.
Thank you so much, Don. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.